2 weeks ago, when we looked at Revelation chapter 4, we discussed how that chapter emphasized worshiping God the Father. And there was a great picture of all those that were gathered around the throne, the elders, angelic beings before the throne, talking about how holy God was, how worthy He was to be worshipped. Now in Revelation chapter 5, it's essentially the same scene, except now the focus switches from God the Father to God the Son. And we basically see when we combine chapters 4 and 5 that when God the Father is worshipped, God the Son is worshipped. When God the Son is worshipped, God the Father is worshipped, because they are one God. There is one divine nature, one divine essence, one divine being. So when one is worshipped, they're all worshipped because they are one in essence. Revelation chapter 5. And there's two or three tremendously important lessons we learn here about worship, who's worthy of it, and why. Revelation chapter 5. Read with me. Verse 1 introduces this scene. And I saw on the right hand of Him who sat on the throne, who is God the Father, a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with seven seals. And we know from both prior chapters in this book and in other books how the scrolls, the books at that time, were for the most part rolls of parchment, rolls of papyrus, where they were written on, usually, I mean, not always on both sides, but sometimes on both sides, but typically just on one. And so it was unrolled from one end, and then it was read, and then rolled up. But here we have a scroll that's written both on the inside and on the back. It's completely filled up. The idea of complete runs throughout this entire chapter, with the use of sevens, with the use of completely. And here we have this scroll which is going to give us, give the church in the first century in particular, the information they needed to know about what was going to happen. And since it was represented as being written on the front and on the back, it was everything they needed to know. There were no blank spaces. There were no voids on it. It was everything these people needed to know. On the front and on the back, and it was sealed with seven seals. We'll talk more about the sealing in a minute. But the fact that it was sealed with seven seals, seven again being that important symbol of completeness and perfection, it was totally sealed, completely inaccessible to people. John couldn't open it. Paul couldn't have opened it. The other apostles couldn't have opened it. You or I couldn't have opened it. No one could open it, and that's the idea. No one had the power, the worthiness, the ability to open it. So it was sealed with seven seals, and no one could open it. No one could tell what that vital information was written on this scroll. And we'll see in a minute where that caused John some great sadness. Then I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and to loose its seals?" And no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to loose it. So I wept much, because no one was found worthy to open and read the scroll or to look at it. None of those mighty angelic beings, and they are powerful, they couldn't open it. They didn't have the power to open that scroll. And this scroll, as we're going to see in future chapters, was basically telling us and them the future of the church, what was going to happen to the church. So under John was sad and wept and kept on weeping, it's present tense in the original, kept on weeping because he wanted to know what was in that scroll. What was there? What was going to happen to the church? What was going to happen to the Christians? They were being greatly persecuted. What was going to happen to the Roman Empire? Was the church going to be crushed? See, the people wanted to know that. They needed that information. And John sees this scroll and knows it's important and knows it's what they need to know. And yet there's nobody in heaven or on earth or under the earth with the power, the qualities to open it. Where is such a person going to be found? So John is weeping. It's interesting, the word worthy there in verse 4 is the word dunamis, which is the original word for power. Who has the power to open and read the scroll or to look at it? And of course, it wasn't just opening it and reading it. It was, you know, understanding it and bringing forth that knowledge. And then, of course, the one able to do that was the one able to bring about what was going to happen. See, it wasn't in men's hands. What was going to happen to the church wasn't in men's hands. It was in God's hands, and He was going to work it out providentially. So John wanted to know what the future of the church was, like everybody in the first century did. They wanted to know what was going to happen to the church. It was on that scroll. So let's see what happens in the story. But one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep." Remember, the elders are the ones surrounding the throne of God. "Do not weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has prevailed to open the scroll and loose its seven seals." Somebody was found. Who was that somebody? Well, he says who that somebody is. The same person that was revealed back in chapter 1 of Revelation. The same person that in Revelation chapter 2 and 3 walked amongst the churches. Who was that? The Christ, the Anointed One, the Son of God. He was the tribe of Judah, right? The Hebrew writer talks about, I think it's Hebrews 7. It's either Hebrews 7 or 8. That talks about how Jesus came from the tribe of Judah. Why was He a lion? Why is He depicted as a lion? Because in this same chapter, He's depicted as a lamb. A lion and a lamb, talk about two things that seem so opposite of one another. Well, they're both stressing different qualities He had and different things He was involved in, different activities, works He was involved in. He is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He is powerful, able to bring about great things. So John, don't weep. There is someone able to do it. Someone that came from David's line. Someone who has kingly blood in him. He was a direct descendant of David, right? Matthew chapter 1. He was a direct descendant of David. Had royal blood in him. And only he could be that king. Only him. The same one described in Revelation chapter 1. He prevailed, he was able to, because he was worthy, powerful, had the ability to open it and to loose its seven seals. John begins to feel a little better. He was afraid there would be nobody there capable of opening that and telling the church what was going to happen. So what happens? "And I looked, and behold, in the midst of the throne and of the four living creatures and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb." Now, he'd just been described as a lion. "A lamb, as though it had been slain, having seven horns," there's seven again, "and seven eyes," there's seven again, "which are the seven spirits," there's seven again, "of God sent out into all the earth." What an amazing verse. Was there a literal, actual, physical lamb like we see today in heaven? Of course not. Because heaven is not a physical place. There's nothing physical, right? There's nothing in heaven that's corruptible, right? 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Paul talks about how this mortal must put on immortality. This corruptible person must be made incorruptible. Why? To inherit heaven. Because nothing corruptible is in heaven. Not a physical lamb. But that's the picture. Why? If you were a Christian in the first century, especially if you had any Jewish background, or even if you didn't, and you had the ability to read much of the Law of Moses, what's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear the word lamb? Sacrifice. The very first thing. And that's what would come to the mind of these people. Sacrifice. This lamb that John sees in heaven, why had it been slain? Because it was sacrificed. Why were lambs sacrificed under the Mosaical system? To atone for sin. Why had this lamb been sacrificed? Why is it seen by John in heaven as being slain? Because it was there to atone for sin. As though it had been slain and it had seven horns. What was the significance of horns? You go back in the Old Testament, whenever horns are mentioned, they almost exclusively refer to one thing: power. Power. And even today, some countries grind up horns of different animals because they believe there's power in them. Well, here, how many horns did the lamb have? Seven. Not one, two, three, four, five, or six, but seven horns. This lamb was totally powerful. We sometimes use the word omnipotent. That's the idea. Completely, totally powerful to bring about anything that was in God's will. So you're in the first century. You're being persecuted in Laodicea or Pergamon or Philadelphia or Ephesus. And John tells you what he's seeing in heaven, that there's a lamb there that was slain for you. They know who that is. Everybody that read this knew who that was talking about. Talking about Jesus Christ. They knew that. And John is saying, this lamb has seven horns. The people in the first century knew what horns represented: power. Jesus has all the power necessary to bring about the future of the church. That's the encouragement they needed to hear, and that's what John is telling them. The lamb has all the power needed to bring this about. No more power is needed other than what he has. And really, from chapter 5 on, we see how Christ is the focal point of bringing about all of these things and his role in it. So he has seven horns. He is powerful. He can bring all of this about. He also has seven eyes. Again, throughout the Old Testament and into the New, eyes represented knowledge. Knowing. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the earth. The idea, does God have physical eyes? Of course not. And do they run? Of course not. But for us to understand how much knowledge God has, then we have the picture of all these eyes running all over the world, seeing everything at the same time. And that's what John is trying to get across to the people in the first century. God has all of this power, all the power necessary, plus he knows everything that's going on. He knows what was happening at Laodicea in the church every second of the day. He knows who's being persecuted. He knows why they're being persecuted. He knows how they're responding. He knows all of that. Why? Because he's depicted as having seven eyes. And so he has all of this knowledge and all the power necessary. He doesn't need anything else. It's interesting, and I bring this up as I started the sermon, almost the exact same attributes and descriptions found in chapter 4, which refer to God the Father, are found in chapter 5, which are talking about God the Son. So again, the divine being, the divine essence, has all the same characteristics, the same attributes, the same qualities, the same powers. They are truly one. They are the Trinity, but they are the one as well. So what happens? He has all the power, all the knowledge, all the insight. And what are these seven eyes? They're the seven spirits. He'd already talked about the seven spirits prior to this chapter. Sent out into all the earth. Those seven spirits we already talked about in prior times, talking about the Spirit of God. Complete, total, perfect in every way. That one section should have given the church in the first century a great deal of comfort. Do we ever forget that? Do you ever forget that God really has all the power He needs to bring about His will? He has all the power. Or do we ever forget that God knows everything that's going on? You don't have to raise your hand, but I will for you. Because I forget that. I forget that God has all the knowledge. He knows everything that's happening. He knows every single thing that is happening in your life. Every last thing. Nothing escapes Him. And He has the power to bring about His will, whatever that will is. So what happens? The Lamb is there that is slain, having seven horns and seven eyes. Then what happens? Well, then the Lamb comes and takes the scroll out of the right hand of Him who sat on the throne. The Lamb is worthy. He has the power, the ability. So what does He do? God the Father is seen sitting there on the throne, very much like Daniel chapter 7. Remember that great scene in Daniel chapter 7, where I think it's verses 13 and 14, where God, the Ancient of Days, is seen sitting on His throne. And one like the Son of Man comes to Him, and what does He get? A kingdom, an everlasting kingdom. Dominion and power and authority is given to Him. And of course, that's a great scene of when Jesus ascends from earth, Acts chapter 1, goes into heaven, where He receives that kingdom, and He's sitting there by the right hand of the throne of God now. And so we see that here in Revelation chapter 4 and chapter 5. What does He do? He takes the scroll out of the right hand of Him who sat on the throne. Now notice the response. So far we've basically been looking at what Christ, because of who He is and what He's done, and because He has the power and the worth to open the scroll, we've seen Him go and take the scroll out of the Father's hand. John was very, very sad because he didn't think there was anybody able to reveal what was going to happen to the church and if it was going to survive. See, the people in the first century didn't know if it was going to survive or not. They thought that might be it. They might have thought the Roman Empire was going to completely come in and crush the church and that'd be it, and it'd be done and over with. Nothing more. So John is privileged to see this great scene in heaven where this scroll has that knowledge on there, and John is so close, there's the scroll, but no one to open it, reveal the contents, and bring the contents about. But someone is, one person, the Lamb that was slain. John's happy, but there's a bunch of other people that are happy too. Notice verse 8. Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And we probably need to stop there just a moment to mention one or two things that are, I think, worthy of our attention. Verse 8 gives us permission, by the way, to have musical instruments in church. Well, I didn't know if anybody would be paying attention or not. If you've lived very long in the church, you've heard that. Hey, they've got harps in heaven. They can have harps in heaven. I can have them here in the church. That's been a reason put forth for a long time. Let's say that were true for just a moment. What else are we allowed to have in church then? Golden bowls of incense. Hey, if you can have, if one is authorized, the other is authorized. What else is said to be in heaven? Hey, there's not going to be any marriage in heaven. Well, I'll be. We can't have any marriage on earth then. Remember, they're not given in marriage in heaven. So if the things that happen or don't happen in heaven is the rule by which we live on earth, then we can't have any marriages anymore. See how, when you put it like that, how ridiculous that argument is? As some people say, what proves too much proves, and so it proves nothing. What kind of harps are they? Are they a real harp? Physical harp? Of course not. There's nothing physical in heaven. It's a spiritual realm inhabited by spiritual beings. Whether they be angelic beings, whether they be the spirits of just men made perfect that Hebrews talks about. So they have a time of worship. Isn't that what he's stressing here? Worship in heaven. How are they worshiping him? Verse 9, and they sang a new song, saying, you are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain and have redeemed us to God by your blood, out of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. There is a tremendous sermon in that verse, those two verses. It talks about the worth of the Lamb. And what's the primary reason that the Lamb is worthy to open the scroll and reveal that? Because He shed His blood for everybody. That's the reason. Notice He didn't shed His blood for just one race or one kindred or one family, did He? It says, out of every tribe and every tongue and every people and every nation. Who's excluded? Nobody. So those people in Saipan, where Pat's going, Jesus died for them. People here in Granby, regardless of where they came from, Jesus died for them. Everybody. There are no races or families or tongues or nations or anything excluded. He redeemed us. He bought us with a price. Why? Because of His blood. And as a result, He's made us kings and priests, or a kingdom of priests. Revelation chapter 1 says basically the same thing. And we are. All of us. Remember, we're called a royal priesthood by the Apostle Peter? We're a royal priesthood. And we shall reign on the earth. Actually, it's present tense. We are reigning on the earth, the original tells us. We are reigning. Right now, I'm reigning on the earth. I don't have a physical throne because this isn't a physical reign. We want to make so many things in the Bible physical because that's what makes us comfortable. Our physical things. But rarely are they. We are reigning. We reign by our lives, Romans chapter 5. And that's a whole other lesson in and of itself. But we are. So there's the worship that's going on. They're singing this new song. And then I looked and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures and the elders. And the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands. You think he's trying to tell us exactly how many are there? Well, how would you interpret thousands of thousands then? What's the exact number? Too many to number, right? Too many to number. What are they doing? They're worshiping. All of them are worshiping. The elders, the living creatures, the angels are worshiping. Worthy is the Lamb, this is what they're saying, who was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing. This is like a great description of the Lamb. It's like one great description in several parts. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and such as are in the sea and all that are in them, I heard saying, blessing and honor and glory and power be to Him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb forever and ever. And again, we see the worship being directed to whom? God the Father and the Lamb. Why? Because they're one. They are one. They are God. And so the worship is directed to them. Who is worshiping them? Everything, right? The whole creation. That's the idea. And then he ends, verse 14, and then the four living creatures said, Amen. I agree. So be it. And the 24 elders fell down and worshipped Him who lives forever and ever. You put Revelation chapter 4 and 5 together, you have a tremendous scene, description of what John saw as far as worship goes in heaven. All of these elders and the four living creatures and the angels, the angelic beings, and then all these creatures on the earth and under the earth worshiping God, the Father, who's on the throne, and the Lamb, saying, You are worthy to be worshipped. Chapter 4 stressed why God the Father was worthy. Chapter 5, why the Lamb, the Son of God, is worthy. And why was the Lamb, the Son of God, worthy? Because He shed His blood. Because He shed His blood. Because without the shedding of blood, there can be no remission, the Hebrew writer tells us. He's the one able to open the scroll. It's a very happy scene for those Christians in the first century. When they got to this part of the letter, they were very happy. They were very encouraged. They were built up because they knew who really controlled the future. It wasn't the Roman Empire. It wasn't the cults that went around trying to get Christians to worship the emperor. Those people didn't really have any power. They thought they had some power, but compared to God, they had nothing. It was the Lamb who had the real power. Why? Because He had died for them on the cross. I mentioned a while ago, He died for everybody, every race, kindred, family, tongue, everybody. And so wherever we go, as Pat mentioned this morning, to the tiniest speck, I think he was talking about Marshall Keeble, the tiniest speck left on this planet, that was somebody Jesus died for. So He died for everybody, so that everybody could have forgiveness. Everybody could have salvation. And they all could have it the exact same way. The people in the first century, people today. By placing their faith in the Lamb that was slain. By changing their lives, turning them around. By making a great confession before men and then being immersed. Because that's where we come in contact with the blood. Immersed in water for the forgiveness of sins. Well, if you have any need tonight, I encourage you to come as we stand and sing this next song.